it is complicated for that reason, because when you are creating steps on an assembly line, you have to understand every single step that happens in the assembly line.
Welcome to DevDiscuss, the show where we cover the burning topics that impact all of our lives as developers. I'm Ben Halpern, a co-founder of Forum. And today I'm joined by a new co-host, Katie Davis, who is also one of our newest colleagues here at Forum. And she's going to step in for Jess on today's topic. Katie, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Katie Davis. I'm a senior software engineer here. I'm pretty excited. I was brought on to work with the front-end team, and we're building out a little team here. And today we're talking about code splitting and the long list of things you need to know when you're writing JavaScript with Lori Barth, staff software engineer at Gatsby and an instructor at egghead.io. Thank you so much for joining us, Lori.
Excited to be here. This is a fun topic.
Absolutely. We had a show in either season one or two with Adi Osmani about people's least favorite things about their favorite languages. And I feel like the topic of today's show, the long list of things you need to know about JavaScript, you know, acts as a bit of a sequel to that show in some ways. I feel like we're getting into a little bit more depth, so folks should check out that episode from the backlog if they feel like it. So Lori, can you tell us a little bit about your background as a developer?
So my background's sort of all over the place. When I started my career, I was in the federal government, and then I was a consultant for 7 years, and so I used to joke that I didn't have a tech stack. I had sort of whatever the clients told me I needed to work with. And one of my very first clients was Angular 1 and very, very early days TypeScript with a Java backend. And that's sort of where I started. And then over the years, you know, there'd be some stuff with React and some stuff with Vue and that sort of a thing. But I'd be doing backend and databases and DevOps and all of these other things that, like, I don't actually enjoy that much. And so I got to the point where I said, okay, I think it's time to move out of consulting land and go to a more focused product company, which is Gatsby, where I am now. And it was great because I got to play with JavaScript all the time because I am a JavaScript geek. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. Like, one of the things that I volunteer with is the TC39 Educators Committee, which TC39 is who determines the new pieces of syntax that go into JavaScript. And the Educators Committee's job is to release all of these posts about these upcoming proposals, normally things that are in later stages and sort of crystallized, and they're determining whether the feature is going to be adopted. And we teach everyone else about it so they can also join the arguing. That's sort of like we contribute to the trolls education. And it's great and it's fun. And like, I love JavaScript and all of its quirks, and there are many. And I actually don't do that much front-end development, which is funny because I work for like a front-end framework. I do mostly what I call middle-end development, which is like all those browser APIs and Node APIs and packages and libraries and all those things that, like, honestly, a lot of people don't have to work with because they're making apps that are for local development only and they don't get shared to another team. So a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today are in that world because it's stuff that a lot of JavaScript developers don't actually have to think about, but it ends up being super relevant even with single repo projects that are just for your team and they're not necessarily some library or shared package.
That's amazing. I mean, you kind of touched on like what you work on at Gatsby, but do you have like a specific project you work on, or as like a staff developer, are you just all over the place?
I'm on the OSS side of things. So we do have a product, Gatsby Cloud, which is like the CI build tool for Gatsby, the framework, but I work on the framework side. And so we have a framework team that works on literally like the core Gatsby package, but Gatsby is a plugin ecosystem. And so pretty much all of the functionality is officially maintained packages. And so I am on whatever package is the flavor of the month that we either need to fix or like add new features to. So we've been spending a lot of time on images lately. I was working on this really in-depth code mod. It's like ASTs and Babel parsing. We were working on a brand new CLI interface. So it's all over the place. It jumps around and it's almost like consulting in some ways, because I joke, I'm like, I just have to dive into a brand new package library that like I've not seen and worked with. And all of a sudden it's okay, learn a completely different thing with completely different technologies that integrates in a completely different way. So it's a lot, but it's a lot of fun too. You learn a lot.
So Lori, you wrote a post on Dev entitled Code Splitting Explained.
I did.
Which was a bit of the inspiration for the show because we really like the post, but it seems like
Thanks.
It's a follow on to a lot of JavaScript explaining you've done in your career as a public figure, an author on dev. Can we start by explaining code splitting for the folks who haven't read that post yet?
Code splitting is interesting. So what people may not realize is that when you write a JavaScript application and you do sort of like your NPM install or your Yarn install locally, you download all of these dependencies that you have defined in your package.json file. And when you actually build your site, some of those dependencies come along with you. So there's dependencies that you have because you're doing local development, like Prettier or whatever, but there's also dependencies that you have that are for runtime. So they actually need to be a part of your site when it's running in the browser. And when you pull up your website and you have all these runtime dependencies, they actually get downloaded like with your site. When you go to your site, there's all this stuff running in the background. If you look at DevTools, for example, it's sort of this wild performance tab view where there's just all these dependencies getting loaded. Well, all of those get loaded as a single bundle in the like default case scenario. Code splitting is the ability to bundle those dependencies and those things that you need to download into different smaller chunks, because when you have chunks and it's not just one big thing, you get to start making decisions about how you download them. So you can say, you know, this is the very first thing I want to download and I want it to be available as soon as I get to the page, the very first thing. And everything else I don't care about until later. It doesn't matter on first page load. I'm going to lazy load it. Or you can say all of these things matter, but I can't download them all at once. I'd like to do them in parallel. Like there's optimizations that you can make there, but none of that is possible if you haven't split up the bundle in the first place. So that is literally what code splitting means. It's splitting those bundles or pieces of dependency, runtime dependencies up so that when you go to a site and you're downloading all of those things, you get to make intelligent choices about those smaller pieces instead of this like giant chunk.
And like, this is a newer way of writing JavaScript, right?
Yes. I mean, newer is relative, right? Like, yes, but definitely. And I think for a lot of people, familiarity with working in browsers can be sort of strange. And you're like aware of Webpack or you're aware of Browserify, but there's all of these framework level abstractions where you don't see these things happening. And so a lot of modern frameworks, because those things are complicated, are actually doing this for you. And so there's code splitting that happens that gives you performance benefits that you aren't even told about. But if you're doing it natively, or you see something weird in a framework that you're working with, and you're like, why is this doing like Webpack chunk, whatever? Like, that's what it's doing.
So would you say like some of that was what inspired you to write a post about this topic?
So actually what inspired me was we were working on this image package, and my colleague was dealing with this really gnarly situation where there was a lazy loaded import that we had that was causing a bug. And basically the bug was, if on your first page that you went to in your site, you didn't have an image, the lazy load on the second page that you went to would take too long. Like it needed to load the first time you went to the site, regardless of what site you went on, rather than just on route change. And so he was changing all these things around, and he had this line that was just inline. It wasn't at the top of the file that said, you know, import whatever from lazy hydrate. It was import lazy hydrate dot then inside the code. And I was like, I know you can do this, but like, why are you doing this? It just sort of makes it messy. And he was like, oh, that's for the lazy loading. And I was like, oh, of course, because we overload. I have a post about this. It's called, is it Webpack or Node? But it's basically this idea that because we have common JS standards, because we have ECMAScript standards, all these things, there's a bunch of function names that we overload because different technologies are adhering to the spec, but then you don't necessarily know which version of that function you're using. So that import function that I was looking at was not an ES6 import function like most people are familiar with. It was a Webpack import function, which has different implementation under the hood and operates slightly differently, even if it appears roughly the same if you're reading the code, you know, just as characters on a screen.
So let's say I want to support an API that's available natively in Chrome, but not in Safari and isn't coming to Safari anytime soon. I may want to support that functionality, but I don't want to load all the code for the polyfill for every browser. So I might dynamically import the code for that polyfill only for Safari web browsers. And that would be an example of code splitting via dynamic import as a function, but code splitting refers to a variety of approaches, I imagine, library specific, framework specific.
Absolutely. So the example I gave was like, you just want to do it generically always because of performance reasons. The example you gave is a really good one where, you know, only sometimes, depending on what browser, you need to make a runtime decision about whether or not you even need this thing. Like if the API is available in the browser and you don't need it, great, awesome, one less thing to download. And then there's sort of like the third scenario, which is when you're actually writing your JavaScript files, if you have a code condition where you say, you know, if else, basically, and there's a dependency that's required for one and not the other, and you don't want to make the user always have to download the dependency, you can do a conditional dynamic import for that as well. So we actually, again, we introduced a bug where we were requiring this dependency that was only necessary for a specific way of using the plugin, and that's not what you want to do, right? You don't want to make people add dependencies as sub-dependencies of the package that you're giving them for sort of no reason unless it's actually going to be used in the code that they're running. Because, you know, deduplication, but also like tree shaking and all. I hate using those words, honestly, because I think they're sort of jargony and people don't necessarily need to know them. They're not super understandable. But the idea that you don't want to have dependencies in your project or you don't want to have code in your project that isn't actually being run.
I would like to clarify, though, like how tree shaking fits into this.
The best way to explain this is if you are working in an IDE and you get one of those little like red squiggly lines in VS Code or whatever, that you've put a return statement and then you have this other line of code and it's like this code will never be hit because you have a return statement for it. That's sort of what tree shaking is about, but it's not something that you can necessarily statically analyze. It's analyzed at build time and it's saying, okay, this code that you just built, there's a whole section of code that will never be run in this scenario. And so we're not going to include it. Or there's this whole, I mean, it's mostly for dependencies, right? So there's all of these functions in the dependencies that we're not going to use. So there's a lot of different ways to talk about how this ends up shaking out. I mean, tree shaking is a problem and isn't necessarily implemented in a way that's super usable right now. It's great in concept, but it doesn't always work. But there's ways in which people have implemented things that are like sort of tree shaking. So for a long time, when you use Lodash, you had to download the entire package. And they created a Babel plugin that basically goes through and says, okay, we're only going to conditionally import like these three functions and you don't need to include everything else. And that was their way of sort of getting around having to do tree shaking for the entire library where there were just hundreds of functions and people were only using, let's say, two of them, but they'd imported the whole thing.
Can you sort of give us some examples of different ways we can use code splitting to be more performant?
The good example is if you're importing something into a file and you don't actually need it for, let's say, 50% of the use cases, and there's some kind of condition that says, you know, if you go here, I'm going to call the function I just imported. You probably want to dynamically import it inside that code because then it's not getting grabbed in cases where it's not being used. But for most people, it's having an understanding of how rendering on your site works. I mean, honestly, this gets into some of the nitty-gritty of like understanding how pages are rendered on screen, the order of operations, how things download, like when React comes to be, and it doesn't always have to be React, right? This is just the example in my head. But there's a lot of different steps that happen. And so if you can make, if you understand those things and you can make intelligent choices and say, I know that I want this thing to load before the layout of the page is available, for example, then you get to start making choices. Or I know I don't care about this thing because it's an interactive thing and I need to have everything on the page before anyone's even going to click on the form field or A/B testing or whatever. Like there's a lot of those things, but it requires you having an understanding of how you intend people to use your application to a certain extent. It's all context driven because for some people, the most important thing in the world is that the hero image is the first thing that appears on their page and nothing else can happen. For other people, as long as you can click the button, it doesn't matter if all of the background images showed up because most people are just trying to click the button to get off the page, right? Like different user experience concerns.
Let's talk about how code splitting comes to be in certain popular tools. So, BuildSteps, Webpack, Browserify how it might work specifically in Gatsby. Can you give us a little bit of overview about some of those things?
So code splitting in Gatsby, we are using Webpack. So we have sort of our own implementation, and you can do your own Webpack config on top of that, just like you can do your own Babel config, but we have our own Babel config, but all of that is handled that way. And so there's a lot of chunking that happens. I mean, we're doing a lot at build time, and so the considerations of how that runs are maybe a little bit different. I mean, I guess the original question was like, how does it come to be in all of these systems? And I think the answer is like, it's hard. Like, people build libraries to solve these problems. It's literally why Babel exists. It's why Webpack exists. It's why Webpack is so complicated. I mean, there's this joke going around. I feel sort of bad, but it's like, you know, should I learn Webpack to be a web developer? And everyone's like, no. And everyone says no, because it's complicated and it's hard because what it's doing is complicated and hard, which is why so many frameworks are adding it to the configuration that they handle for you, because it's one less thing you have to learn and one less thing you have to know. And if you do know it and you are willing to learn it, you can always do more on top of that. But they want to give you sort of like the default behavior they expect will be relevant for the majority of use cases for the majority of their users. And that's really helpful and really important, because I know like the tiniest bit about Webpack. Like, I know enough to make something work and probably hack it through. And it reminds me of a tool called Gulp that used to exist. I mean, it still exists. I'm trying to think of a good way to describe it, but I think a lot of people are used to like serverless function these days. Actually, state machine is a better explanation. So a lot of people who have played around with state machines have realized that it's sort of just like a giant switch statement with keys and saying do this, then this, then this, then this. But it can be this whole workflow, right? Where you split off in this direction or this direction or this direction, and you could map out the whole thing. Webpack is sort of the same thing, but it's for building your site. So it's saying, I want to build all of the CSS files, and then I want to build all the JSX files, but I only want those to be transpilable using this JavaScript. And then there's some TypeScript files, and so I want those to be transpiled this way. And then when all of that's ready, I want to query the GraphQL that's inside all of these Gatsby files. And then when that's ready, I want to run all the image processing. And then when that's ready, I want to build the HTML, right? And like, and so on and so on and so forth. And so it's really just this giant workflow. It's an assembly line. It is an assembly line of building your application. And it is complicated for that reason, because when you are creating steps on an assembly line, you have to understand every single step that happens in the assembly line, the order that they go in, the edge cases that exist between them, your starting form, and what you want your ending situation to be. Like, that's a lot to know. That's literally understanding everything about everything, and that's why it's hard.
I actually really appreciate you saying that, because Webpack is very hard, and that's why like Parcel has come out, right? And it's supposed to like easier Webpack. And like, I think especially as a front-end developer who writes JavaScript, you take code splitting for granted, because like you spin up a Create React app and it's just done for you. Yeah. Like, I don't have to configure anything.
And that's the way it should be, right? Like, I'm the last person who's going to sit here and say like, you should do it yourself so you can learn how it works. Like, no, if you don't need it, don't learn it. Like, learn what you need. But when you get to a certain point in working with JavaScript and in building applications, you start touching more of these sort of third rails of JavaScript. And you have to start learning them. Just, I mean, maybe you're curious and you're like, why has this always worked this way? Or maybe you have some really gnarly bug, or you are building something from scratch because existing tools don't meet your needs. And that's cool. And that's great. And that's why we talk about these things.
There's certainly an anxiety of choice in the JavaScript ecosystem sometimes.
Yes.
I think sometimes you just want the tool you're using to make the choice for you, so you don't have to figure out Webpack versus Parcel or versus Gulp or the things that came before it.
And then there's like Rollup and Snowpack, which I haven't looked into. Like, they're in our code base, and I've sort of seen examples of them, and I don't think both of them are in our code base. Rollup is, maybe Parcel is. I can't remember anymore. Like, this is the problem.
Yeah, I certainly have some latent anxiety over different eras of this type of work. I'm really happy that Ruby on Rails integrated Webpack and won't change that until some future decision that the framework will maybe make and allow us to transition. But, you know, it's kind of like, almost up to someone else to figure out if we need to move to something like Parcel, and you certainly could, but there's a default and there's someone else deciding like, this is a decent default for now. I have really appreciated that because I've had certain periods of anxiety over someone in an organization I've been with proposing a new build tool and me being worried that this might also need to change 6 months from now. Like, Webpack seems to like have had some lasting power, even if it's pretty complex. At least it gets a lot done and is fairly standard. And some of the new tooling maybe seeks to simplify what it does, which is probably a good alternative. You got something that's very all-encompassing and has a lot of configuration options. And then things that came after it, which maybe seek to reduce some of that for simplicity, which is probably a good direction to move in. What you probably don't want is something that's like extremely exactly equivalent that is now replacing it and becoming the standard.
Yeah. I think it's also like worth noting that, I mean, anytime you switch out technologies, that's stressful and depending on how much work you need to put in. But to me, in terms of, you know, potential for catastrophic consequences, the build tool is like the last thing you want to have to change. And so if you don't have to and it's working and you can keep it stable, I don't care what the latest and greatest thing is. Just like keep going.
Agreed.
Yeah.
There's a legacy code nature to it that is perfectly acceptable to me personally. I'm sure other people have different views, but this is the argument, right? If you're building something new, I mean, Twitter-driven development, the joke is everyone's building something new because they're always using the latest thing and they couldn't possibly be switching their stuff over every 5 seconds for, you know, whatever the new hotness is. But in most cases, that's not reality. And a lot of, I mean, people say Angular is dead. Angular is far from dead. Angular is everywhere and will be everywhere for a very long time to come because it is in millions of legacy systems. I mean, there's stuff that I built 7 years ago in Angular 1 that is still in Angular 1 and will be in Angular 1 for probably 3 to 5 more years until they decide to rewrite it after like a decade plus of being in use. And you don't always need to trade out what you're working with. And so these conversations that we have about like what in JavaScript is hard, and we mention all these new tools and some of them make it easier. Yes, some of them make it easier. And the next time you have to use a tool, maybe you reach for that. But if you're not building something new and you have something that you've configured and it works, do not ever feel pressured to pick up the new fancy, snazzy, everyone says it's so easy to use thing, unless your existing legacy tool is giving you heartache. In which case, by all means.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of recruiters that come after me with like ASP.NET.
Oh, yeah.
Postings, like, I think we're safe with legacy code. My old work still has a gulp file running first. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, and then there's stuff that like intimidates me. Like, you all, Forum uses Preact, and I'm just like, I know it's a thing. I don't want to look at it. It's a whole other world. Can of worms. Don't want to do it.
Well, the nice thing about Preact is it's mostly a copy of React with a slightly different underlying.
So I'm told, but every time I have ever been told something is a copy, it is not.
Oh, yeah. It's also diverged, I think, over time. I'm not sure I remember how to do React development so much because I've been using Preact.
Right. And like almost the worst situation is when someone tells you it's a copy. This is how I feel about having used TypeScript in its infancy and then not using it for a bunch of years and coming back to it is I have patterns in my brain of what I expect to happen because I think I know the thing. And then it's changed ever so slightly, but not enough for me to notice. And then I'm like, oh, crap, I'm in trouble now. And so this is my fear of Preact, right? That like it's close enough, but also different enough that it's going to be 10 times worse. It's harder to learn something when you have existing patterns in your brain that you have to break than it is to learn something from scratch.
Absolutely. I will say a week into it, Preact does seem exactly the same as React to me. So if that makes you feel better.
All right. I'm going to need a Twitter DM when you find like the 4 edge cases that are going to haunt my dreams.
I'm sure I will right after this.
On this topic, what I think is nice about dynamic imports in code splitting is that you can apply them selectively and get some wins. So you can start using some dynamic imports. You can take a look at what's on the top of the file and say, hey, this isn't needed until later. I can put this somewhere else without having to overhaul the code. It's not really a structural change as long as it fits the needed pattern in line. And when I started getting into using some of those APIs, that's how I felt. I was able to make a few optimizations within the file without any major decision making having to happen outside of that context.
Absolutely. That's how things become more approachable and something that you can onboard into, because you can do it in stages instead of kind of like an entire rewrite. I will say, like, when you're using the actual Webpack build script that you have, that one is maybe a little bit more challenging to do the overall code splitting depending on what your current setup is. But for the inline dynamic imports, where you're literally in a file and you're using that import keyword within the function that you wrote, that's great. I mean, you can go to 5 different files and say, I have Webpack installed in my system. This is going to grab the Webpack import. I'm going to do import this random thing dot then, and it just works. And I can remove the top line import. And that's amazing. Like TypeScript, there was a streamer I was watching the other day, and they were talking about sort of the phases of migrating over to TypeScript, and that it's not all or nothing. And you can do it in sort of this, I'll introduce this piece of it, and then I'll introduce this piece of it, and then I'll introduce this piece of it. And that's awesome. And you can absolutely do that with code splitting. And so if you know you have these built-in wins, that's a great way to get started and be like, I know this thing is only used if you happen to hit this specific line of code, but we have to have it for this specific line of code. Great, cool. Go in, add the import inside your code and make the whole thing a promise. And then you can delete that top level and all of a sudden it's automatically code split for you, which is the example in the blog post, by the way, if anyone goes and finds it, that there's a code snippet you can steal that literally does just that.
I did want to ask, it was mentioned to me, there's this thing called Semver, and it's a tool that you use. Can you explain to me? I've never heard of it.
Okay, Semver is a standard, but it is a standard that has been adopted by, for example, NPM. And so every time you install something for your project, you're installing a dependency that someone has put up in a package repository, whether you're using Yarn or NPM or whatever. It has a version number, right? And we all know these. It's like the 0.0.0. That's the form that it takes. Semver is the rules that package developers need to follow every time they bump those numbers up. So if you bump that last number up, you have literally just said, I built a new version of this code. There's some lines changed in it, but it's implementation details. It's not really going to affect you. If you bump that second number, then you're probably adding some features. If you bump the first number, which is when people talk about it's V2, it's V3, it's V20, you are introducing breaking changes. And you can't introduce breaking changes if you only bump one of those smaller two numbers. It's like breaking the code of Semver. And Semver is how I pronounce it. I've only ever seen it written. The reason this is really important is because in your package.json file, you have these extra characters. So if you look at your dependencies or your dev dependencies even, you see the keyword of the package and then the value is this version number. If you have a tilde in front of it, it says, if I run npm install on this, I want you to download the version that I just pinned and increment the third number, the smallest number, as high as it'll go. So like the latest tiny upgrade bug bump. If you have a caret, you want that second number. You're saying, I want to upgrade the minor releases every time I run npm install. There is no special character to do major release bumps automatically for you, because most people would never want to do them because they introduce a breaking change, which is why this stuff is really important, because if you introduce a breaking change outside of the Semver spec, then you're going to break people's sites because they have these automatic version increases set up. So that every time they build their site, they get the latest and greatest, which is good. This is how we get bug fixes. This is how we address vulnerabilities. This is how we have, you know, small performance improvements, all of those things. But it requires that everyone sort of like adhere and agree to this specification, both package authors and package users, so that you know what you're getting into.
Thank you. Thank you. No one ever explained that. Like, I use it all. Thank you.
I have another dev post on this. It's called The Anatomy of Package.json. Beautiful. And it goes into the dependency section. It talks about Semver. It talks about the different characters. There's a bunch of different characters. You can have like a range of versions that you're comfortable downloading. There's a whole world, but there's sort of a couple typical ones that are most commonly seen.
And as a consumer of some of these packages, this emphasizes the big no-no of using private APIs, which may technically be available to you, but the maintainer of this technology doesn't think you're using them, so feels free to change them as they feel like
and break them.
And call it a patch or a minor change. Whereas if you're consuming a private API, your code could break when nobody else's would.
Yeah, that's actually a really good thing to bring up. So at Gatsby, we run into this all the time. And there's a few different ways we run into this. Recently, we're releasing something new. It's going to be a brand new thing. And we literally have a giant caveat where we say, hey, if you dive into the structure of this object, we reserve the right to introduce a breaking change because we are not creating this to be a publicly available API. It's the structure of the object. We promise to give you what we've promised to give you, but we might change tiny things here and there. Conversely, there was a package I was working on and we tried to make a change and we discovered that a former employee's blog post introduced this function that was in our minds private because it wasn't in official documentation, but as a way to do something. And now we can't deprecate it. Now we can't change it. Now we can't remove it because there's all these people relying on it because it became a public thing. It's hard. It is hard to be a package author, but it's also hard to be a package consumer. Like the JavaScript ecosystem is this really interesting contract between everybody. And I love that. It's sort of everyone working together in this like weird codependent situation. But it can be challenging because you don't always know how people are going to use the code you put out into the world. And that's especially challenging when you're creating things that you expect to be publicly consumable or you don't expect to be publicly consumable.
It must be challenging in the development of Gatsby to maintain a pace such that you're giving people new things they care about while also maintaining all of these expectations. And that I would think that the pressure for Gatsby to not lose out to like new things that may be less sophisticated but newer and don't have legacy dependencies, I imagine since the company does this project and there must be a lot of strings pulling at you. Can you speak to some of that?
Yeah. I mean, it's all a balancing act, right? So I will say like, we have a wonderful community. We've always had a wonderful community and they really help us when they see things that one, we shouldn't have done. Like when we make a breaking change in what we thought was a private API and it's not, and they're like, oh, hi, we were using this. And we're like, okay, cool. Thanks. Appreciate it. We'll roll that back or figure out a way around it. And they're also great when they find things that are broken and they'll flag it or they'll fix it, which is always wonderful. We love being open source in that way. Yeah, no, it is challenging because we have a lot to maintain. We have a lot of, you know, this official plugin ecosystem means all of these different integration and touch points that are relevant and that need to be maintained and need to be upgraded every time these things change. But I mean, that's the nature of the job. Every job has their challenges. And we do our best to try and make sure that we're still pushing out, you know, new features and big, awesome things that people are going to love. But it takes a little bit more time when you're dealing with things that you have to, you know, continue to support and you know that your users are relying on versus greenfield programming. I mean, we all know this. If you have an empty file, you can create something potentially a lot faster than if you're working within, you know, five different files that already exist and a bunch of integration points. And that's what we deal with every day. And that's cool. That's great. We are happy to be at this point that we have a mature enough product with enough users where we have to worry about breaking those things. And yeah, sometimes it means that like we have three cool features to release instead of 10 new cool features to release. I mean, it's probably like 3 versus 5, let's be honest. But it means that we have done well by our users and we have a user base that is expecting those things from us. And like, that's super awesome at the end of the day.
I actually wanted to ask, in terms of like you produce so many NPM packages, but while you're developing, like how do you make decisions around what you consume? Because I obviously like size, bundle size is important to you. Mm-hmm. What does that look like at Gatsby?
So we work in a monorepo. So all of our packages are in there. And every time we see if there's something that we're adding that's brand new to all of the packages. If it's something that already exists in the giant yarn lock that was being used in these other dependencies, we're like, okay, this isn't a big list. It's something that we're using elsewhere. If we see something that's new, that's when we start making decisions. But honestly, we've done that a lot less lately. We pretty much know what our dependencies are. Sometimes we'll be able to swap something out and say, hey, this is going to be smaller. This is going to be more performant. We were doing a new CLI recently and we were like, oh, we think we're going to use Inquirer instead of Ink, for example, because it was something new. We got to make that choice. But at this point, unless it's making an intentional change to move away from something, we sort of have our bases covered in terms of the dependencies that we require. It's a lot of GraphQL stuff. It's some image processing stuff. It's a lot of like small utility libraries. Lodash shows up there a few times. That's actually the funny part. Most of the dependencies you look at in our different packages are other packages that we own. So it's like we're importing from our own APIs at this point.
Lori, since you began developing JavaScript, how do you think things have changed for the better? I think the evolution of code splitting maybe for the better and there's downsides, but what's improved for the better? And then maybe, you know, what might be degrading or getting worse?
Yeah. So I think specifications have gotten better. So whether that's ECMAScript adding new things, like Lodash is an incredible library, and there's now a lot of things that were originally introduced in Lodash that are part of the main JavaScript language. That's great. That's awesome. That means it was a useful piece of functionality that is now standardized across all modern browsers. It doesn't require another dependency. It's native. That stuff is awesome. Same with the browser APIs. Like, we're getting better every day about being standard across all of these different experiences so that it's easier and more consistent to be able to develop for, you know, like a mobile phone company I've not heard of, for example, versus, you know, me staring at my desktop. That's great. In terms of stuff that's degraded, paradox of choice. I mean, there's just so much. I give React a lot of crap for this sometimes. Like, Vue made a decision. Vue was like, okay, we're going with Vuex and Vue Router. And React was just like, there's 20,000 things all vying for your attention. And a bunch of frameworks have followed suit. And there's now all these things that were built for React or were built for Gatsby, for example, that you can use in all these other places. And you're just looking around and you're like, oh my gosh. And I think that's really intimidated for people to get started. And we don't do a great job of telling them that, like, the tool that works is the tool that's right. And if there's a better tool later and you discover it, awesome. If there isn't, awesome. Don't feel like you need to do research on 20 different things and pick the absolute best one and defend your choice in front of a, you know, jury of your peers, right? Like, we need to move away from that if that's how people are feeling. That is by far, I think, the thing that has changed. When I started and it was like, oh my goodness, we're moving away from struts. First few projects I did were in struts, and then it was like Angular 1. Angular 1 was the only thing there. And then all of a sudden there was Angular 2, and there was React, and then there was Vue, and now there's Svelte, and there's Redwood, and there's and it's just like, wow, where do I even begin? So do I get to ask you that question, both of you?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I want answers.
I think the greatest thing that has happened to JavaScript recently, to be honest, is like the adoption of functional programming, just because it gave people a set of rules that were maybe a bit easier to understand. I feel like once we started bringing currying and like Lodash and those libraries, and we got into array methods, like people felt a bit more confident in programming in JavaScript. And we moved away from that sort of like jQuery slap together kind of stuff.
What, you don't like the dollar sign? I talk about the dollar sign all the time as being like the worst symbol choice ever.
Please, one day I will tell you about the framework I worked on that hijacked the dollar sign and used two dollar signs. And it was...
No, no. Oh my God, I can't even imagine writing that parser right now. I'm going to cry. Okay, go ahead.
So I would say that, like, I feel like you said, the language is becoming more robust. We have like a lot of great stuff being built into it. I think the thing that is like a kind of a bummer, or like that I'm worried about with JavaScript, it's just like with all this decision fatigue, with things like changing constantly, other like developers kind of hate on JavaScript developers. And, you know, there's a lot of like talk on the internet, like people who write in JavaScript are abandoning things all the time. They can't make up their mind. They're not real programmers. They're just all over the place. It's really just for experimenting. And like, I see things like Electron, I see things like React Native, and I'm like, JavaScript can be everywhere. It's like easy for people to pick up, and I want it to be like very robust. And I do get worried that when we have all this like decision paralysis and all these constantly changing too fast things, that it like gives JavaScript kind of a bad rep.
Ben, you're up.
Yeah, I'd say what I think has been a breath of fresh air is the collaboration between JavaScript and the browsers to create certain types of front-end APIs that act as good progressive enhancements alongside code splitting, I think, plays into all of this so that you might be able to make use of certain types of progressive enhancements on a case-by-case basis without incurring all this load for users. But APIs that can detect network conditions, things like that, I think help the whole ecosystem work well in a way that is fairly backwards compatible as long as you're using things the right way. So I think lately there's been a lot of cool new stuff coming out that seems like an objective improvement if you make it. It's not like a language decision where it's like, okay, maybe this is an improvement or a tool that might improve my flow, but only as a detour to actually improving the user experience. I think that there's been a lot of tooling that interacts with the JavaScript ecosystem that has really empowered the language. I think the popularity of JavaScript has led to a bit of a degradation in terms of some of the coding bootcamp options there are. There's a lot of centralization around just teaching JavaScript and Node, which has a lot of good things, but I think that there's this ecosystem-wide situation where a lot of developers really only know JavaScript in a way that I think like has good and bad parts. But just maybe 10 years ago, I feel like when the boot camps were coming up, there was a little bit more versatility in terms of what they were teaching. There's so many boot camps that just do full stack JavaScript that it, I think, degrades some of the education options out there. It's like a regression to the mean in terms of the vibrancy of what you might get into as a programmer.
That's really interesting. It also makes me laugh because I'm like, I think part of what I appreciate about JavaScript, I learned from Java, PHP, Python, and a couple other things where I'm just like, oh, I'm so grateful for you.
Laurie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I would never have guessed it was your first time, Katie. You did great.
Thank you. You were an excellent guest.
Well, I thank you. That's a mutual admiration society.
Thank you all for listening. This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp, editorial oversight by Peter Frank and Saran Yitbarek. Our theme song is by Slowbiz. If you have any questions or comments, email pod@dev.to and make sure to join our Dev Discuss Twitter chats on Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Or if you want to start your own discussion, write a post on Dev using the hashtag Discussed. Please rate and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts.